This book has been optioned for film. Is that right?
Yes. Well, that was a pretty cool little bit of news. I got an email a few months ago from a guy who is a casting director. He actually did the casting for Dallas Buyers Club and Spotlight and several other big films. And he bought the film rights and he brought in Deb Granick, who's the director of Winter's Bone and another amazing film, which the name is escaping me right now, but as an executive producer. And so we're pretty excited.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Russell Rowland about his 2019 novel, Cold Country, which has been optioned for the silver screen. In this conversation, we'll talk about Russell's own history with moving to a ranching community as a boy, along with his return to Montana as an adult. Stay with us. I want to enter the book via one of the main characters, Roger, who's a fourth grade boy. And in the book, you make reference to the work ranch kids have to do at home, making school challenging because it feels like two full-time jobs. And I was wondering, why was it important for you to bring to light the life of ranch kids?
Well, you know, this was probably the most autobiographical book that I've written. It was based on a time when we did move to a ranch, and I was 10. And, you know, it was just such a big adjustment for me as a kid who'd always lived in town. Even though my grandparents had a ranch, I'd never actually lived the ranch life, so to speak. So, and you know, the way that the community responds to a new family was just so fascinating to me, especially, you know, in hindsight. At the time, it was more of a, like, what the hell's going on here? But, I wanted to incorporate all of that into this story because it was just such an amazing learning experience for me as a kid. Learning the work ethic, I mean, stacking hay and stuff was just so intense, but also incredibly satisfying. So,
yeah, I have this thought that I want us to just jump into the text itself. Will you read a page for us?
Okay, so this story is centers around a family that moves to this ranching community, and the kid, the 10-year-old kid, gets into a fight at school. The next day or so, this rancher comes to talk to the father, giving him a bit of a warning about just making a bad first impression. And then that rancher who gives him the warning ends up murdered a couple days later. So, you know, there's an immediate sense of suspicion among the community that this new guy is the natural suspect. So that's the basic storyline. This takes place right after they've found out about the murder. There comes a day in Montana every fall when everything turns. Every speck of color drains from its home and soaks into the soil until spring, when the pigments have rested enough to reappear in a brilliant explosion of color. Overnight, the grass and leaves soften to a muted tan and the bark on the trees fades to gray, until the entire landscape is so overwhelmingly tan and gray that one cannot imagine it otherwise. Even the evergreen mountains, glorious and enormous, cannot save this dull season. In 1968, this change came on a Saturday, the day after Tom Butcher's body was found beaten beyond recognition. The birds pointed their beaks south that morning, as though they feared implication. Flies dropped from the screens, piling in windowsills. Carl Logan awoke as usual before dawn. He sat out in the yard at the picnic table with a cup of coffee. As the light leaked into the sky, Carl felt the effects of the muted landscape. He watched the mountains emerge from the blackness, and he sat thinking with some amazement how quickly his view of these new surroundings had changed. Just a couple of weeks before, this country looked so wide open and forgiving. Now he could almost hear the chatter rolling from the surrounding ranches, could almost picture the mountains moving toward him, his neighbors descending from the trees, surrounding him and his family, closing in, their fingers aimed at his chest. Carl closed his eyes and pressed his fingers into the lids, trying to soothe his thoughts, trying not to wonder if moving here had been a selfish, horrible mistake. Carl had just decided to make some biscuits and gravy for breakfast before Lori got up, when she burst from inside the house, running toward him with the most frightened look on her face. "Roger's gone," she said.
One of the things I love so much about that passage is you so acutely describe that day in fall, and you really name the landscape. And I want us to be able to talk about Western writing in a bit, but I just want to stay with the plot for a second. So Roger is the son of Carl Logan and Mrs. Logan, and they move from the city to this ranch, and Tom Butcher is murdered. Roger takes off. And there's this really crazy scene that follows this in which Roger's father finds him by a creek. And you wrote this: "Roger turned his head without panic, saw Carl, turned back calmly again to his fish and the scene before him. The motion was so adult, so free of fear, that Carl couldn't decide how he felt about it." And I, for a moment, I thought, oh my gosh, is that what parents experience when they watch their kids grow up? You know, like that moment when your child does something that both surprises you or scares you or delights you, or all of those at once. I was wondering, how did you come to write that scene or know that feeling?
Oh man, that's a tough question. Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, so much of this story sort of revolves around the challenge to the male Western character, you know, what it means to be a man in the West and how we respond to things. I think that was a huge part of what was on my mind as I was writing this. I guess, yeah, your question is great. I mean, as far as how do we see that in ourselves and in the people that we grow up with, I guess it's always kind of surprising when you're raising kids and you see them cross over into some new, you know, realm of of adulthood or just being their own person, I guess, you know, even is so exhilarating. So I was trying to capture those little moments, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, is the exhilaration of being your own person.
Yeah.
You follow this thread. You know, this book holds a lot. It covers infidelity and domestic abuse and alcoholism. And this, you know, Tom Butcher character is this fairly sort of hyper-masculine character that we come to learn dresses up in women's clothing. And I was wondering, what was your intention in queering up, you know, like cowboy and ranch?
Yeah. Well, you know, the main reason I threw that in was because I just was trying to imagine what it must have been like, especially in that time, to have that kind of a secret and to be somebody who's so well known in the community as this macho, manly guy, you know. And so much of this story focuses on how everyone in the community feels a bit like an outsider and how nobody really wants to acknowledge that. So I couldn't think of much better way to have this guy be sort of like the ultimate outsider, somebody who would, you know, probably be shunned if people knew.
Right.
You know, so yeah, that was ultimately the one of the main themes of the book, was everyone there, even the ones who are the most popular and the most accepted in the community, has their own reason for feeling like they don't belong. And I wanted to explore that.
Right. And if I follow that thread to loyalty and belonging with the landscape, you know, Tom actually says at one point, you know, my dad used to say all the time until I got sick to death of hearing it, we're married to this land. No other marriage counts when you live out here. That's like, huh. What do you know about that kind of loyalty to Montana?
Well, you know, my grandmother or my mother grew up on a ranch, and I witnessed it firsthand, you know, how so many people from the family felt that kind of tie to this place. And, you know, you always have questions about how much of that is a curse and how much of it is a blessing. You know, for some of them, it was an awful connection. And for some of them, it was something that they really lived for and thrived on. So it's just interesting to try to explore how people respond to that kind of forced connection, you know.
Right. And you write about the stubbornness of rural people. And, you know, it was the stubbornness that brought their ancestors west here in the first place. And you write, a stubborn, idealistic belief that they could carve a life out of a place that showed very little promise. You know, I think about the poet Tammy Holland. She also speaks to this. The plains, especially the silences that occupy the plains. I think about the prairie madness that consumed, you know, like the women who are brought west. What's your relationship to stubbornness, and where are you at in your marriage with Montana yourself? Because you have a podcast, 56 Counties. Clearly, you're invested.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things that I really wanted to put a lot of time into when I moved back here in 2007 was, you know, how much of my relationship to Montana has been positive and how much of it has been negative, you know, because there's definitely both sides to that. My great-grandparents on both sides of my mother's family were homesteaders, so we have a long history here. And there was definitely that stubborn insistence on trying to make things work no matter how bad things got. And the way that has carried through in our family is fascinating to me. And, you know, there was madness. There was people, you know, institutionalized the whole deal. So the impact was really powerful. And I have found in my own experience here, especially when I traveled to all the counties for that book and now for the radio show, I just love Montana in a way that I never expected I would when I came back. I mean, I knew I was excited to come home, but to find out how much more the positive has outweighed the negative has been an incredible surprise and a really delight to find.
Can you name some of those positives?
Well, I think that there's just a common decency here that people share. And, you know, it's funny because I've lived in 12 different states since I graduated from high school here in Billings. And I heard this all the time from people all over the country that, you know, Montanans are different somehow. And I've never been able to quite put my finger on it, on exactly what it is that makes us different. But part of it is that just sort of general openness and friendliness that you experience no matter what part of the state you're in. You know, there's maybe a little bit of wariness in the smaller towns, but overall, people in Montana are eager to get to know other people, you know. So I love that, but also the persistence, you know, this sort of undying optimism that we have about you know, no matter how bad things get, there's always a chance that things will turn around. That's so big, such a huge part of my family history, and I've definitely inherited that.
Thank you. If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Russell Rowland about his novel, Cold Country. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. In the second half of the program, we'll talk about what it means to write the West, along with Russell's own radio program and podcast. Don't go away. You know, I was asked recently by Spokane Public Radio about the literature of the regional West, and I was wondering, like, what do you think the writing of the West is becoming, and what does it mean to get it right about writing Montana?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, one of the things that I find really irritating about the Eastern view of Western writing is that it's considered regional. And I understand it, but there's so many amazing writers that have come out of Montana, and I kind of bristle at the thought that we're not taken seriously, in part because we write so much about this relationship to the land. But to me, I mean, what better metaphor is there than people writing about the relationship with the land? I mean, and with animals and with, you know, the environment, that there's so much to explore there and to delve into, that it doesn't make any sense to me that people look at that as sort of somehow lesser.
Right, lowbrow art.
But exactly. And, you know, you see the same thing in the visual arts, too. But anyway, I think that there's going to have to be a natural sort of transformation into writing more about the urban aspects of the West and how we're being forced to look at new ways to make a living here as the, you know, the agricultural community shrinks. So that's going to be a fascinating transformation, I think.
Russell, I have another favorite passage in my book, and I was hoping you would read it because I think it takes us into other big themes.
So much of Roger's story is based on real life. So like the opening scene where he's standing there in his loafers.
Yeah.
That was real.
Did you have those loafers?
I talked my mom into buying some loafers for me right before we didn't know we were moving to this ranch. My dad sprung that on us at the last minute.
Oh no.
My mom didn't know that he had even interviewed for this job, which you can imagine how well that went over.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, this scene, we used to play Midnight Ghost, which was a game where you run around the schoolhouse and there's one person who's a ghost and they try to capture the rest of them. So yeah, this scene is based on that. When he found himself in a clearing, he ran. Roger ran for his father. He ran for his mother. He didn't know it, but he ran for Tom Butcher and Hazel Moses and Babe Ruth and even Arnie Janko. He ran for Rosa Parks and Chief Joseph and Elie Wiesel. He ran for Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King. He ran for every woman who had her feet bound and every man who felt a noose around his neck and every person who was forced to wear a yellow star and every girl who was snatched from the street and whisked away. He ran for the centuries of human beings who had felt different and alone, trying to escape from the discerning looks and the condescending tones and the lash of persecution, his breath racing through him like a gust of wind. And even when he got to the sidewalk where the game ended, where he had won, he kept right on running.
Whew. So, Russell, this book takes place in 1968, but when you start invoking those other names, I wanted to know why draw a line through history like that?
Well, it's kind of what I was talking about before, the feeling of being different, the feeling of being left out or not fitting in. That was such a huge part of my experience living in that community. And I think probably everyone who lived there felt it to some degree. So I just wanted to try to draw that connection out between, it's sort of a human condition, I think, that no matter how much other people might think we fit in, there's always that part of us that doesn't quite feel it, you know? And so I wanted to capture that. And it's funny that you would pick out that section, because when I wrote that section, I was so convinced that my editor was going to tell me to cut it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And she said, "This is so good."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, thank you." So sometimes we surprise ourselves, you know.
Yeah,
that's one
right.
of the things I love about writing.
Right. I mean, it does. It seems like those moments where we surprise ourselves in the writing maybe connect us to a greater source. I don't know if you feel like that as a writer.
Yeah. No, totally. I agree 100%.
Russell, I was hoping to touch on your podcast and radio life. You have a literary
yeah.
show where you tie books in from the past and the present with Aaron Parrott. And I was wondering, can you conceptualize the show for me?
Yeah, that's been a lot of fun. It's called Breakfast in Montana. And Aaron and I, we became fast friends like the minute we met. And we've been talking for years about writing a book about the history of Montana literature, because it just has such a rich history. But we could never quite get ourselves motivated to do that. So I suggested this podcast to him just as a way of sort of inspiring us to get started on the book, which still hasn't happened. But yeah, so we talk about one book from the past and one from a contemporary writer, and we try to find a connection between them. For instance, we had one episode with Jim Harrison and his daughter, Jamie. And it's just been really fun to try to bring some attention to books that have been forgotten or maybe never quite got the attention they deserved, like Rick DeMarinis's The Burning Women of Far Cry, which is an incredible novel. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun and a great way to sort of talk about how Montana impacts the people who choose to write about it.
In 56 counties, you interview people in Montana and you address sort of the main question is like, how has Montana shaped you and how are you shaping Montana?
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind
yeah.
of right? And you ask really intimate questions of your guests. And
yeah.
it got me thinking, like, what do you like about the one-on-one conversation, Russell?
Well, you know, I think it's really challenging to get people in Montana to talk about personal things. I mean, almost every single person I've asked to be on the show has said, well, I don't really have anything interesting to offer. So there's that sort of like, oh, shucks, you know, self-deprecating mentality that is so Montana. But I think the personal experiences that we have here, everyone has an incredible story to tell. And getting people to open up about those things, you know, like I assume you might be thinking in particular about Alexis Bonagofsky talking about her dad's suicide and, you know, stuff like that. You don't hear people talk about it enough, I don't think. And I think it's really important that we open up those kinds of conversations here, because we do have such a huge suicide rate, among other issues, that I think it's important that we talk about.
You do it in such a casual but honoring way. You know, like nobody seems put off by you're just being like, so. Which I think is like, it's really good to see like a big, tall, white Montana man like just going there. So
thank you.
I was pleasantly surprised. Russell, here's my last question.
Okay.
If I'm going to address the fourth grader in you with those loafers, how are you finding ways to belong and also stand out?
Ooh, wow. Well, I suppose, you know, in the end, it all comes down to the common ground. You know, I dealt with my own personal demons when I was a young man. I quit drinking and went through all that. And So I've been able to find some sort of a foundation to feel a little bit more grounded than I was as a young man. So that helps, but I also still feel like I just don't really understand everything I want to about what it means to be from this place. So I go into every situation, every interview, and every, you know, podcast with the feeling that I just want to learn more. I'm not an expert on any of this stuff. I'm still sort of stumbling through it, trying to figure it out for myself. So that's my approach to it. And it makes it so much more interesting, and it feels like I'm always learning new things. So I love that part about what I do.
And what about the, like, what's the 2020 version of loafers for you?
Well, I still don't look like a typical guy from Montana. So I get a lot of funny looks wherever I go.
What, for those of us who have never met you, what might be a typical outfit or something that we'd see?
Oh, well, I wear a lot of pork pie hats. I can't think of Birkenstocks and, you know.
I love it. Granola jazz.
That's right. Yeah, I would fit in more in Missoula for sure.
Yeah, you're welcome here anytime. Russell Rowland lives in Billings, Montana. He's a critically acclaimed author of 6 books and a literary podcast host, as well as a mentor to fledgling writers. A 4th-generation Montanan, Rowland was born in Bozeman in 1957, inheriting the experiential legacies of his father's blue-collar Wyoming roots and his mother's 100-plus-year ranch family history. He earned an MA in creative writing from Boston University, where he finished his first novel. His website is russellrowland.com, or you can look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.